This is Dr. Gisela, isn't it? Gisela.
Mm.
Eisner, Villefort. And if I could ask you then a little more about your communications with home. This is sort of overlapping with the last tape. Once war started,
yes.
You know, what the situation would have been.
Yes, but we exchanged some messages through the Red Cross. I don't know whether this is sort of standardly known. These were messages restricted to, I think, 25 words each, and there were some restrictions on what one was allowed to say or not. I know I had one return to me when I innocently wrote to say that Stephen had gone to Australia. That was promptly returned back to me by the censor and with the command that I was not allowed to say anything, mention any place names. But there were a few of these messages which I exchanged, and then at the end of 1941, my brother Helmut sent a message to say that our parents had gone away in that sort of language, and that he was on his own. So that was pretty really evidence that my parents had been deported, although I must say at the time, I didn't actually recognize it as such a drastic operation. I thought perhaps they'd just been moved somewhere else. I mean, I had no idea at all that deportation meant what everybody knows it meant nowadays. And then I exchanged one more message with my brother, and then I heard no more from him either. And that was in 1942, so sometime during that year, he himself must have been deported as well. I have no more information as to what happened to them until my brother Stephen, got some information through the International Red Cross Search Services, who've discovered that my parents had been taken, put on a train, officially bound for Minsk at a certain date in November 1941. And then one just doesn't know what happened then. That's all we know. And both they and my brother were declared dead officially at the end of the war. That's all we know.
Yes. You know, I wonder how you felt during the war, you know, that England was at war with Germany and you were in England. Were you terribly worried about your parents? You know, not having heard from them or Helmut after that date.
I was very worried after I hadn't heard any more from Helmut, yes, yes. But until then, I think, in a way, one sort of had got used to beginning to accept things, even though I knew my parents had gone away, as my brother put it. I don't know who at that time actually would have recognized that expression for what it actually turned out to mean. I mean, I knew it couldn't be anything better than, you know, it couldn't have been an improvement on their situation, but certainly one would not have thought that might be the final journey. There is another thing, of course, that I was living at that time in Chesterfield. It was a very small society. I was together with people who were not terribly sophisticated, and they just listened to the news. They never sort of interpreted news or tried to second guess what the announcer was actually saying or what any other politician might be saying. So one just sort of tended to accept things literally, and I mean, it never occurred to me to sort of imagine anything more than I was told. I think that was really the situation.
Did you sort of suffer any dilemmas, though, during the war? You know, the fact that you had come from Germany and now, you know, Britain was at war with Germany, the place where you were living. You know, did you suffer any sort of torment or dilemma over that?
Do you mean sort of personal comments by people? No, never, never. Nobody ever said anything. You know, the only thing that used to upset me sometimes was that adults, as I said, children never did that, but adults would sometimes ask me personal questions about where my parents were and what they were doing when I think, really, deep down, they knew, but they just wanted to hear me say it, I think. I imagine so, or perhaps I just imagined that that was what was happening. But as I say, my contemporaries never did that.
Were you ever involved with any of the raids?
No. No, when we were in Wolverhampton, well, before we actually moved to Chesterfield, and when Mr. Gwinnett had to start his new job in Chesterfield, we lived in Mrs. Gwinnett's mother's house in Walsall. That was early in 41, yes. I'm just trying to think, 39, 40. No, it was late in 40, wasn't it, when all the raids started in this country. And we used to hear the planes going over to Birmingham, and sometimes one would hear a thud. And we never experienced anything close by. And then in Chesterfield, there was no incidents. And when I moved to Nottingham, they had only one raid throughout the time, throughout the war, and that had happened before I moved there. So no, I had no personal experience of any air raids.
And nor any anti-German feeling from people, if they knew.
No, I didn't, no.
How about your brother, you know, when he became a member of the forces and eventually was taken prisoner? Would you have been informed about that as next of kin when Stephen was taken prisoner in Italy?
Yes, because by that time he changed his name again to Turner, and he became Tony Turner's surrogate brother. And he was informed when Stephen was missing, and he rang me and told me about it. Yes. Yes, that was really quite an experience too. But I never really believed it. I never really believed that I'd never see him again. I think by that stage I'd sort of decided that he was my only brother, my only close of kin. He couldn't possibly be dead. So I know that amazed some people. They were very surprised that I sort of didn't go to pieces. But I just didn't believe it because, you see, that was sort of late in 44, October 44, and by that time I sort of by then everybody knew what had happened to Jews left in Germany. I mean, I knew that then I knew that I'd never see my parents again. I mean, I knew that was hopeless. And Stephen then was my only relative, so he couldn't die.
Yes. So how was it you finished the war, you know, you were working towards your 3-year degree, you were saying,
yes.
Which you got, of course.
Yes.
Yes. What was that in? What did you read?
I did a Bachelor of Commerce degree, which was very much like an economics degree, London University. They ran that in parallel with an economics degree. I went to Nottingham to a job. I was directed to work there. With a company manufacturing sanitary towels. And they didn't know until sometime after I started what they actually manufactured, because they always talked about sanitary goods. It's amazing when one looks back on it. Now these things are all advertised on television. And we were in the office, and the factory was next door. Never saw what was going on there. That was for a few weeks, and then I changed my job and I went to work for the fire guard service. That was an auxiliary fire service to sort of make use of volunteers, because there weren't enough fire brigades to cover an area when there was sort of some incidents. And they trained volunteers to give immediate help after an incident until the big brigades could turn up. And this was a reserved occupation. I worked there for about a year, and I went to night school, and I got my inter-BCom the year after. And then I actually did quite well. And they said, the university college then said that I should try and come in part-time to some of the lectures during the day. And I did that. In order to do that, though, I had to get a job which wasn't full-time, and I started teaching at a private school in Nottingham. and I taught English grammar. So I hope my tape isn't full of terrible howlers now. And I did. And then the final year, I went full time as a student, because by that time the university gave me a studentship, which left me off. I didn't have to pay fees, and they gave me some extra money to live on. And then I borrowed some money from some friends in Chesterfield, and the International Student Service gave me some money, so I had just about enough to live on. So that last year I was a full-time student. Then I got my degree.
And that would have been towards the end of the war, would it?
That last year actually was after the end of the war, 45 to 46, yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember VE Day, when the day war was announced?
Yes,
that it
I can, yes, yes, yes.
Could you tell me about it?
It was absolutely amazing. I didn't really feel anything sort of excited myself, but the amazing thing was I hadn't expected that when I walked across the main square in Nottingham. Do you know Nottingham at all? Now, there's a huge square in front of the town hall, and everybody always used to congregate there. During the war, there's always full of servicemen, sort of looking for a bit of friendship. And that was absolutely packed full of people drinking and singing. And they were all dancing things like Knees of Mother Brown. I mean, can you imagine it? I mean, obviously people were very happy and their sort of war was over, that's it. No, I didn't get excited about it myself. I mean, it didn't seem to make any difference to me. I mean, all these people who say they were terribly excited. I dare say people were excited who sort of husbands and boyfriends were in the services and they were expecting them to come home and they knew they weren't in danger anymore, but I didn't have that sort of thing to look forward to. By that time I knew Stephen was all right. I'd heard that sometime earlier. He'd been home by then, yes. Yes, he'd been home by then. He'd been back to England. Yes, he'd come earlier.
Did you have any intention after the war of returning to Germany?
No, never. There was a strong group of people in Nottingham I came across, the Free German Youth, who were keen on going back. They were amazing, these people. I met them at the International Centre in Nottingham, and they were very determined to go back. They kept up their German and they sort of did all sorts of classes and lectures and to prepare themselves for it, and they went back to East Germany. It's quite amazing. Yes. The people from the refugee movement got a bit worried about them. They didn't like them. They thought they were a lot of communists and they were sort of letting the side down. And they didn't like that. Oddly enough, the person who was really the main spring behind that movement was somebody who said he wasn't Jewish, that he'd left for political reasons. And when they all went back, then we heard afterwards that he actually had been Jewish. He just pretended not to be, to make himself, give him something extra, because, just to be a little different, not just an ordinary Jew, helps. I thought it was slightly pathetic, but still. He was very good at his job at organising, but he obviously felt he needed that little bit of extra.
The fact that you didn't want to go back to Germany, did that mean that you felt you belonged in Britain at that
time? Yes, yes.
Was that where home was for you?
Sorry?
Home was Britain, was it?
Yes, I mean, I sort of felt more at home than I sort of remembered having left behind, really. Yes, I think I'd really sort of absorbed everything, yes.
Had you applied for British nationality?
I think I did. I don't think I knew about it or anything about it until 47 or something like that. I think I got my naturalization just before I married, and we married in 48, so it was about 47, I think. Yes, it wasn't anything that was terribly important at the time, I don't think. I mean, not compared with getting a job and making ends meet. I think most of my existence around about that time and for a few years previously was really sort of, you know, looking after the next step and carrying on. There was no sort of long vision. I mean, when I decided on doing a degree, I hadn't got some sort of grandiose object in mind of what I was going to, why I was doing it. I was just going to do it to see if I can do it, really. And it didn't really matter terribly what subject I did. I mean, I chose this BCom degree because it was something I could do without having to do a lot of sort of prior preparatory work. If I decided to do sciences, for example, I would have had to spend extra time beforehand catching up with all the science I hadn't done at school. Or that would have applied to some of the other degree courses as well. It just seemed the easiest one. Just to see if I could do a degree. Really, nothing more noble or uplifting than that.
You then went on to do a doctorate, though.
Yes, a little while later, yes. Yes, that was not until after we came to live in Buxton. And I got a job at Manchester University then in the research department. And I was incredibly lucky then because I got a job with Professor Arthur Lewis, who was a West Indian, and he wanted somebody to do something about a historic economic study of Jamaica. And I found this very interesting, actually. And then I thought, I'm doing all that research work on my own. I might as well make use of it. And I said, was it all right? And he said, yes, go ahead and do a PhD if you want to do it. So I did the study, and that was accepted as a PhD thesis. Yes, I spent 5 years there.
Have you ever returned to Berlin?
Yes, I did about 10 years ago. I went there. I went on my own. Herbert didn't want to go with me. I went on my own. And I expected to be terribly upset, but I wasn't. Once I'd sort of looked for certain places that had been familiar to me and didn't find them there anymore, I sort of really began to feel like a tourist going to see this interesting city, which in fact turned out to be rather ugly. But, yes, I mean, the place where we'd lived had gone. The school had gone. That was really worse than the flat where we'd lived because the school had really meant a lot to me. The school had gone. And in fact, it was the only little spot on the Grunewald that had been damaged. So imagine that whoever was responsible decided to dispose of Himmler's old residence. And while they were doing that, the school got affected as well because there was no other damage anywhere around there. And the street has got a different name now as well. It's been renamed. So I imagine this is what must have happened.
Have you actually accepted the deaths of your parents and Helmut, do you think?
I don't know what you mean by... I know they are dead.
Do you?
Yes. I mean, what else could they do?
And your brother as well?
Yes. Yes. I know Stephen said that every now and then he used to think that, you know, one of these days we'll hear. But... I mean, I can't see that even if Helmut had survived, that if he had survived, that he wouldn't have found some means of getting in touch. I mean, nobody was so isolated, were they, that they wouldn't have been able to get in touch with somebody who knew somebody who could get in touch. Yes.
Have you ever been compensated for what happened to your family in Germany? Have you applied for that?
Yes, Stephen and I got something for the deaths of our parents. Yes, yes.
But how about property? You know, the fact that your parents were forced to move from different places. Was anything?
Yes, yes. We wouldn't have got anything for our parents having to move from place to place. It was just a question of what was left at the end when they were deported. Stephen himself couldn't possibly say what was left in the flat or not because he hadn't been home for a long time, and I couldn't really remember accurately either, much less the value of anything. But Stephen got hold of somebody who'd been a very good friend of my mother's and who'd stayed in Berlin, and he got her to make out a list of all the property and clothes and pictures and so on. And either she was too kind and too optimistic about it all, or a lot of the things had already been flogged off or whatever. Anyway, it then turned out that the Germans, when they deported our parents, sealed off the flat and made an inventory of everything that was left in the flat. And in the end, we were compensated what was left in the flat at that time, which was nowhere near the value of what the friend had said. So I imagine that it must have been partly that she was sort of being too kind and putting too high a value on the things, and that perhaps they had actually sold some of the things to keep going. I don't know what it was, but in fact we got a very sort of miserable little amount that really wasn't worth talking about. This friend of my mother's actually was very interesting, because she'd always been a very good friend of my mother's all along. And after the war, she wrote to me and said that my mother had been to see her the evening before they were due to report for this deportation. And she told her about it. And she said, would she come and collect some things from the flat? Now, this Hildegard, as she was called, didn't really believe that this was so, and she sort of took her time over going there, and by the time she got there, of course, it was much too late, and I believe she was really very upset about all this, and that she hadn't sort of done something about it straight away. I mean, what she could have done was really nothing very much, but she herself felt that she was rather remiss in her friendship.
When you look back, you know, to this children's transport, the first one, and what happened to you subsequently, you know, the various moves, the places you were put, how would you rate it, you know, for sort of efficiency and humanity, the way you were treated?
I think I was just treated simply abominably at first, when I was sent to this house with these people, and the way my aunt behaved towards me. I mean, there's sort of nothing else I can say about it. I mean, however inconvenient it was or disappointing it was that I wasn't the little girl or that my aunt didn't want me, I mean, they didn't have to go out of their way to be so horrible. I mean, my aunt never admitted to rub it in that she didn't want me there. I mean, she didn't have to do that. I mean, but the rest I really can't. No, I think the Gwynneths were very, very kind to me. They never sort of complained or anything at all, but I think they can't really have sort of expected or anticipated to get the sort of person they did get, simply because I came from a sort of totally different sort of background and had been taught things in quite a different way and had been taught different things. I mean, in a way, I had a sort of much more cosmopolitan outlook than they had. They were sort of really what people used to call provincial. I don't mean this in a nasty way, but it is a very much more narrow existence.
Would it have helped, you know, to have had an organisation, a sort of billeting organisation, and people keeping an eye on the children, do you think?
I don't think it would have been a comfort to me at all. I think they certainly should have kept tabs on me during the first few months to see how I was settling down. I think it's inexcusable that they never sort of checked up at all. But I mean, once I was settled with this family in Wolverhampton, I think there was absolutely no need for them to do more than eventually they did when Miss Burnett used to come to Chesterfield every now and then. I mean, that was just sort of something one knew that had to happen, but it didn't help or hinder at all. I mean, she was just sort of checking up that, you know, I hadn't fallen ill or died or something. But no, I didn't need more than she had to offer. And I certainly wouldn't have liked to have had the offer of getting together with fellow refugees. I don't think that would have helped me at all.
Do you completely at home in England today.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, later on in Nottingham, for example, you came across these fellow refugees at this international centre, and I don't know, I never felt terribly comfortable because they sort of retain this sort of strange outlook, which I somehow managed to escape with the way I'd lived. They were hypersensitive about being Jewish and about anti-Semitism to such an extent, I think, that they began to see it where it wasn't really intended. I mean, sort of stupid things, you know, somebody sort of gives them a brusque answer to something and they would immediately interpret that as anti-Semitism rather than somebody being bad-tempered or something like that. So I'm glad I wasn't exposed to that sort of attitude, really.
So do you think it helped you to adapt, the fact that you weren't a religious Jew, that you hadn't had that sort of background?
I think that's a big question, actually, a very big question. The point is, if you're very religious, it provides you with a sort of set of morals and habits of thought and ways of life, doesn't it? You stick to, and then you don't have to worry, do I do this or do I do that? It organizes your life for you, doesn't it? I mean, I've had to sort of think, what am I going to do or what do I want to do? But presumably I wouldn't have had to do if I'd had a strict religion to cling to.
But has that helped you, do you think, to adapt to English life, the fact that you've had to choose and find your own way?
Oh, it has, yes. I mean, I'm jolly glad I wasn't brought up in a strict religious sense, yes. But if you ask me, would it have been easier? I think every time it would have been easier, wouldn't it? I mean, if you're a Catholic, for example, you know what you can do and what you can't do. You don't have to choose, do you? You don't have that sort of worry. No, I had an enormous amount of freedom, really, with the Gwynnets and in Chesterfield particularly. I mean, one could always go out. One wasn't sort of cross-examined about when one would get back in again and who one was with. And I met a lot of people, talked to a lot of people, did all sorts of extraordinary things. Chesterfield is actually an interesting little town. It's quite an old town, which has developed over centuries and all sorts of different trades and influences. And it's absolutely full of different religious sects. And I used to know a girl for a time, and we used to go round different evenings to sit in on these different sects, or their different religious meetings. And nobody ever minded that we turned up. Quite extraordinary. Yes, I've always been grateful for all that sort of freedom I had.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Gisela, you know, for telling me about your experiences in World War II. Thank you.